No, he won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No.
Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. We have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, I'll have Representative Kelda Helen Royce will be on to discuss the Gableman issue in her campaign. Then we'll be followed by Clean Wisconsin. They'll finish off the hour. We will be talking about the piece of crap mining bill and the wetland bill that has been recently introduced into committee. In the second hour, we'll start the hour talking with Frank Kane and Cyrus Hester. About how the mine will affect those on the Bad River Reservation and the people up north. And then we'll end the show with Bob Puryear. I knew I was going to get this name wrong. Puryear, who will talk about the correct uses of social media for messaging. He owns his own social media business, and he's really good at doing it, and I'm really excited about talking to him at the end of the show. Now, the phone number to call in is 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. We also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com. You can post your comments or questions there. Now, before I get to Representative Royce, I'd like to thank Tom and Bill for filling in for me last Friday. They did a great job. I was just horribly sick. I was lucky enough to catch the stomach bug and the head cold going around at the same time. So I was really sick, and they were kind enough to step in, and they did a great job. So thank you guys so much for doing that for me. And I also want to make a big announcement. I'm really excited. We can now be heard on WHYS LPFM 96.3 in Eau Claire. So if you want to catch the Sarah Schultz Show on Tuesdays, we will be on from at 1 o'clock, 1 to 3 p.m. We'll be following Democracy Now! And that's at WHYS LPFM 96.3 in Eau Claire. Now, I also wanted to mention on Tuesday, January 17th, United Wisconsin will be turning in the petitions and having a celebration. And I'm just going to read to you a little notice they put out. It's also on their website, and I'll give you the website at the end of this. They want you to join United Wisconsin and our partners to celebrate the end of the petition gathering campaign in our historic effort to recall Scott Walker and Rebecca Clayfish. Special guests include Ed Schultz. This will be at the Monona Terrace from 5 to 8 p.m. Now, there will be a bus departing from the Milwaukee Booth Street offices, 2604 North Booth Street, at 2:30 p.m., stopping at Gorky's Corners Park and Ride, corner of Blue Mound Road and South Barker Road in Waukesha, in between 3:15 and 3:30 p.m., and arriving at Monona Terrace approximately 5 p.m. That same bus will be departing Monona Terrace at 7:30 p.m., stopping at the Gorky's Corner Park and Ride between 8:30 and 8:45 p.m., and arriving back at Milwaukee Booth Street office at approximately 9 to 9:15 p.m. The bus is free, so if you'd like to get down there and you just can't get a car or want to stop some of the global warming going on, you get on the bus. You can RSVP, I believe it's Angelique, at UnitedWisconsin.com. And if you want more information about any of this going on with United Wisconsin, go to www.unitedwisconsin.com. Now I'd like to introduce Representative Kelda Helen Royce. I'd like to welcome Representative Kelda Helen Royce to the Sarah Schultz Show. She holds the seat for the 81st Assembly District. Welcome to the show, Representative Royce.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm really excited to get you on, and especially get you talking about Justice Michael Gableman. Now, you had a press release this week that talked about your resolution to remove Justice Michael Gableman. Let me start off by quoting your press release. The press release said, "We recently learned that Justice Michael J. Gableman accepted free legal services rendered by the law firm Michael, Best & Friedrich, which represented him from July 2008 to July 2010. After accepting what is likely many thousands of dollars in free legal services, Justice Gableman participated in cases involving Michael Best and Friedrich clients, in some cases casting the deciding vote in their favor. By doing so, Justice Gableman has violated numerous provisions of Wisconsin law governing conduct of public officials and Wisconsin's judicial code of conduct." Just what did he violate by accepting the free legal services?
Well, Sarah, it's important to understand that this is not simply a case of he exercised bad judgment or he made a mistake. Justice Gableman violated the law, and specifically, there are two Wisconsin statutes that govern the conduct of all elected officials. One prohibits state officials from soliciting or accepting anything of value if a reasonable person could think that it might influence their judgment, or if it could be a reward for something that you do in your official capacity. And there's also just a general prohibition on elected officials using our position to gain anything of value for our own private benefit. And it's clear that what Justice Gableman did in getting this free legal services, where he never, under any circumstance, he would never have actually had to pay the money, he was violating those statutes. And in addition, because he's a judge, he actually has another code that he has to follow besides just the general rules that all elected officials, including myself, have to follow. There's a thing called the Code of Judicial Conduct, which is under our Supreme Court rules, and it requires judges to act at all times in a way that helps helps bolster public confidence in the judiciary and their ability to be impartial. And it prohibits judges from getting themselves entangled in different financial deals with people, including lawyers, that come frequently before the court. And Justice Gableman did all these things, and he didn't disclose it at any time.
So what brought this, how did you find out about all this that was going on with him?
Well, there's an investigative journalist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Patrick Marley, who actually uncovered this. And had it not been for his intrepid work, I think this would have continued to remain secret from the public. After all, this arrangement went on from, I guess, 2008 until 2010. All the while, Justice Gableman was ruling on cases with Michael Beston Friedrich coming before him, and in some cases, even his own personal lawyer. And so the other litigants that were before him had no idea that there was this dubious financial relationship between he and one of the attorneys coming before him.
And he obviously, being a justice, knew that he was breaking these laws as he was doing it.
Well, he knew or he should have known. But certainly one would expect that any Supreme Court justice would be well familiar with both the ethical rules that govern all public officials and the Code of Judicial Conduct, which applies specifically to judges and justices.
Well, you said in the press release that he ruled 11 times on cases of Michael Beston Friedrich. How many of those rulings did he rule in favor for Michael Beston Friedrich? And even if he didn't rule in favor, just to make sure, he was still breaking the law by even sitting on the bench ruling at those cases, correct?
Well, the rules of recusal are somewhat vague, but legal experts from across the country all say that what Gableman did in sitting on those cases was clearly unethical. Judges have the obligation, if there's a potential conflict of interest or the appearance of a conflict of interest, to recuse themselves and certainly to disclose it to the litigants. So then the person on the other side of the case can say, Judge, it's fine. I understand it. I'll let you go forward anyway because I don't think you're biased. But that's up to the litigants. It's not up to the judge. And so we know of at least 11 cases, and we know that he also ruled in favor of Michael Best's position more than any other justice. But in my mind, those things are certainly problematic. But I think more broadly, I'm very concerned just about the violations of the law. It's hard to imagine a more egregious example of abusing your power as a judge than getting what some have estimated to be over $100,000 in free legal services, on a deal that no other person could get from one of the most prominent firms in the state that is frequently before the Supreme Court.
Now, didn't Judge Gableman have some issues while he was running for justice? And isn't there a background of him doing this kind of stuff?
Well, what's interesting is that the reason that he actually needed legal services is because of ethical questions that were raised about whether he violated the Code of Judicial Conduct during his campaign. His campaign put out a very spurious ad against then Justice Louis Butler. And so many people felt that ad was misleading, it was dishonest, and that in and of itself would violate the Code of Judicial Conduct. And so it was in that ethical proceeding and then defending himself from those charges that he was able to get legal services from Michael Best and Friedrich under this highly unorthodox relationship where he was basically off the hook from paying for it.
Now, this is not the first time this lawyers group has come up in this administration. Are there any repercussions for them about this?
Well, I think those are separate issues that are, you know, there are numerous bodies that handle complaints of this type. I mean, the Judicial Commission, of course, investigates complaints against judges. The Office of Lawyer Regulation investigates complaints against attorneys. I'm looking, from my perspective as a legislator, as to what is my responsibility here. And the Wisconsin Constitution is very clear that we, as the legislative body, have the power and the responsibility to remove judges with a two-thirds vote in both houses. And, you know, voters, for instance, can also recall Justice Gableman because we have elected judges in the state. So there are a lot of different procedures and ways for dealing with ethical violations, legal violations, but I, as a legislator, was looking at what is my remedy given this egregious misconduct of Justice Gableman.
Well, and you wrote a resolution then for this.
Yes, I did.
What does your resolution say?
The resolution simply details the violations of the Code of Judicial Conduct, the violations of Wisconsin statutes governing ethical behavior for elected officials. And it says, because of these, we're acting to remove Justice Gableman from the bench. And so I just released it, and I'm now giving my colleagues an opportunity to read the resolution, consider it, and understand why this conduct is so serious and why Justice Gableman no longer should be sitting on the Supreme Court. Then I'll formally introduce it, and then I think the Constitution requires that Justice Gableman get an opportunity to defend himself, so there will be a hearing or a committee of some type convened so that Justice Gableman can actually defend himself, which he has every right to do. And then the legislative bodies will both have to vote with the two-thirds majority if Justice Gableman is to be removed under this provision.
How many co-sponsors do you have so far?
You know, I'm not sure because I'm not in the office. Oh. But certainly there's been great interest from citizens around the state that have contacted me and said, you know, regardless of political ideology, we want to make sure that the judiciary is fair and impartial. And so thank you for doing this. And so I think there will be broad support, certainly among citizens. You know, this, I should say that even if Justice Gableman were the most liberal judge on the court, what he did was still wrong, and I would be taking the very same action if he were left-leaning judge as he is now.
Well, are there anyone coming from across the aisle to say, yes, we're going to support you with this?
Well, certainly citizens have. And I think that as people realize how egregious Justice Gableman's conduct was and how it totally undermines the public's confidence in our judiciary, people will recognize that all constituents, Democrats, Republicans, non-voters, we all have a right to go before a judge and know that that court will be impartial and fair and that they're not engaged in shady financial dealings that are to their own benefit that we don't know about, that it might prejudice them or at least might make us feel like they were biased. We all have that right as citizens, regardless of our political ideology, and that's really what this is about. It's about making sure that every citizen who goes before the court feels like, hey, I got a fair shake here.
We are speaking with Keldra Helen Royce, representative of the 81st Assembly District, and you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show. Now, when you released your resolution, there was a comment by John Jagler, who is a spokesperson for Republican Assembly Member Jeff Fitzgerald, and John Jagler said, this is nothing but a political stunt not worthy of comment. Now, John Jagler is also the Republican candidate for the newly redistricted 37th Assembly District. Since Representative Fitzgerald he's really been known to make these types of statements in the past, and now he's allowing John Jagler to make them. Do you think there's some political posturing going on here?
Well, I guess I'm disappointed that Representative Fitzgerald's office has basically decided that they're going to be blind to the legal violations and ethical violations here. As I said, you know, this is really not – doesn't have anything to do with ideology or partisanship whatsoever. This is about our responsibility as legislators under the Constitution to remove justices when there are egregious violations of the law. And, you know, we have seen a pattern, certainly, of abuse of power by the legislature and a blindness to the legislature's own unethical dealings. I mean, violations of the open meetings law, trying to shut people out of the gallery, all of that. But, I mean, I really think that this issue should rise far beyond partisanship, because we all have an interest in protecting the idea and the reality of an impartial Supreme Court and judiciary.
So do you see this as another example of Republican hypocrisy then?
Well, you know, if Representative Fitzgerald has decided he's simply not even going to consider this, I think that's very disappointing. It's unfortunate. And, you know, I do not take this resolution lightly. This is a very, very serious thing, and I did not undertake this before carefully considering it, making sure, you know, looking at all of the alternatives and ultimately concluding that this is what the Constitution, this is why that provision exists in the Constitution. So, you know, it's certainly disappointing, but I believe that Republicans across the state, as well as those of all political stripes, will be well served and better served by having another justice on the Supreme Court who's willing to follow the law and be ethical.
Well, do you think that in a Fitzgerald-run assembly, that he released a statement, do you think that this resolution will actually even be brought up in the assembly?
Well, I am certainly hopeful that it will. I think it's always difficult to get anything brought up in this assembly. There have been a lot of good ideas. I mean, even, you know, we've had many jobs bills that we've put forward, and none of those have really been seriously considered, some of our major jobs proposals. We've also had a lot of different legislation, alternatives to the kind of drastic cuts that we've seen for health care, for education. Those have not been considered. But this is something that really goes to the very heart of having an accountable, transparent government. I mean, this is very, very serious misconduct. And so my hope is that citizens around the state will contact their legislators, will say, we want a fair and impartial judiciary. And keep in mind that if Gableman steps down, which in my mind would be the best of all solutions, then we wouldn't have to go through this removal proceeding, Governor Walker will appoint a new justice. And, you know, no doubt that justice will be a conservative one. So this really has nothing to do with the balance of the court. This has everything to do with making sure that the justices who sit on the court, regardless of their ideology, are following the law.
Well, how much damage does this do to undermine our judicial system in Wisconsin?
Well, I think, you know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court used to be regarded as one of the greatest courts in the nation. We were a model. And unfortunately, over the past several years, and particularly in the last year, I think people have really lost faith in the court's ability to function. You know, we've just, it's a tragic thing. And I say that as a citizen and a lawyer. The fact that our court is no longer perceived by the public as being fair, as being impartial. And this kind of behavior, you know, this kind of deal that Michael Gableman got, I think, strikes right at the heart of people's confidence in the judiciary. And so I think it's really imperative that we take serious action. And it is very serious to remove a justice that was elected by the people. We should not understate that. But it's also very serious to have a judiciary that people cannot trust to make good decisions and follow the law.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and I'd really like for you to talk about your campaign. I know the Judge Gableman issue and what he did is very important. We really need to keep talking about that. But I also know you're in the middle of a campaign, and I don't want to leave that out. So we'll get back to that. I'd like to actually bring you back on to talk more about Justice Gableman as things go on. But for those who don't know, you are running for Representative Tammy Baldwin's seat in the 2nd Congressional District.
Now, yes, I am.
What brought you to run for her seat?
Well, I think that we really need bold, progressive leadership in Congress. Our nation is facing some very serious challenges, and I think that the politics as usual kind of status quo that we've been seeing, not just from Republicans but also from Democrats, is not rising to meet those challenges. And in this district, we need someone who's not just going to be a good vote on the issues, because certainly anyone who gets elected from this good progressive district will be a good vote on the issues. We need someone who's going to be a champion, who's going to stand up and be a strong voice and a progressive leader on so many of the issues that matter to people, not, you know, wealth inequality, access to affordable health care, making sure we are preserving and expanding the social safety net, and having fair and accountable government. I also think one of the critical things that we're facing is a political system that's really broken. And the system has been gamed by wealthy, entrenched corporate interests that have been able to basically buy the policy that they want, whether it's tax breaks or whether it's lax regulation. They've been able to totally capture our political system because they are the ones that fund campaigns. And Republicans and Democrats too often go along with that system. So I've made the personal commitment, because I'm so disgusted by the influence of corporate money, that I'm not going to accept any corporate money or any corporate PAC money in my campaign. I think we have to lead by example and be very clear about how our political system is being destroyed by corporate money.
Has that affected you at all, if any of your fundraising that you've been doing?
Well, certainly it's an unorthodox way to run a campaign, a modern campaign, and so it means that I have to work harder to raise money than my opponents and then congressional candidates across the country who are willing to just, you know, take any money that comes in the door. But I think it's really important if we want to be independent, and certainly when I go to Congress, I want to be able to vote based on what's right, what I think my constituents need and deserve, and not based on how it's going to impact my ability to get big corporate PAC checks. And so, you know, I've been very, very pleased. We've had very strong fundraising right from the start, and in the last quarter we more than doubled our number of contributions. So I think people are really responding to this message, and they believe and value having an independent representative who's not going to be just continuing to toe the old line and take corporate money, because that's the easiest to raise.
Would you then, once you get in, maybe make an amendment to make corporations not people?
Yes, I'm very supportive of the Move to Amend movement. And I can tell you, you know, this whole fiction of corporate personhood is, it is absurd that we have taken something that basically is a legal fiction to allow, to make it easier to address corporations and organizations in the law, and we've turned it into something that never was intended by the founders, basically granting corporations more rights, not just equal rights to human beings, but more rights than they have. For instance, human beings can't give unlimited amounts of money. They can't, you know, give unlimited amounts of money to candidates. They have to disclose the money that they give to candidates. But corporations can now spend freely from their treasuries and these anonymous entities and super PACs. And so they are really given much more free rein, and they're also protected from liability in a way that individuals are not. So it's very problematic, and I think we need to take many steps to reform the way we finance campaigns, including amending the Constitution to eliminate this fiction of corporate personhood, and also to make sure that we are financing our campaigns publicly and offering perhaps free airtime to candidates.
Now, how does Citizens United adversely affected Wisconsin?
Citizens United?
Yeah, how has that adversely affected mm-hmm. Wisconsin? You just put out a list of mm-hmm. what you feel you need to do and the steps that need to do to reel this in. But what has it done to Wisconsin that has been such a problem?
Yeah, well, Citizens United has been just a devastating decision. And I think, first and foremost, we saw the most expensive campaigns that we've ever seen in Wisconsin with outside groups spending money where we didn't know where that money was coming from. It was coming overwhelmingly from out of state. And, of course, a lot of it was poured into negative, fact-free advertisements on television. And I think that really, it undermines our political discourse, and it makes it very difficult for us to solve problems once we're in office. It's a very nasty, scorched earth politics. So I think it discourages people from running for office. It makes it harder for us to work with our colleagues across the aisle, and even the colleagues within our own party, to address problems in a serious manner. And it undermines voters' sense that they have a stake in the outcome. People see all this terrible negative ads coming from Orwellian-named organizations like Citizens for a Strong Wisconsin or something. And, and they think, this can't be true. And so I'm just not going to vote, or I'm just not going to engage because it doesn't matter anyway. I'm not a big money player. So all those things are problematic. But I think that Russ Feingold is right, that we need to make sure that candidates are talking about Citizens United, that people are aware of what a departure this is from the way that we have dealt with corporate money in politics for over 100 years. And we need politicians who are willing to stand up and challenge it and change and really lead on this issue.
Well, how can you take what you learned working with the non-compromising Fitzgerald-run state assembly and apply that to the United States representative seat that you're running for?
Well, I think, Wisconsin over the last year has been very good training for going to Washington and dealing with the Tea Party Republicans. But I think more importantly, my background actually before I started serving in the legislature, I ran a statewide organization, a grassroots nonprofit that worked to advocate for women's reproductive health care. And I helped build that organization from just a few thousand members to over 35,000 supporters. And so I really view my job as a political leader, not just write press releases and offer bills, that's all important, but it's really to help engage people in a broader movement for social justice and social change. Because ultimately, the only way to change the world is not just electing the right people, but then holding their feet to the fire so that once we have the power, we can actually do something with it. Some of my biggest frustrations as a legislator were when Democrats had the majority, we had the ability to really make change and, for instance, increase investment in education. And instead of doing that, we took the easy road and were not willing to be courageous. And we said, we don't want to raise taxes. We don't want to address some of the structural inequalities in our system. So we're going to just cut education, but a lot less than the Republicans would. And for me, the measure of our success is not, are we doing things less badly than the Republicans would, but are we doing the right things for our state and making the investments we need to in our future? And I think that's the perspective that comes from working as an advocate, not just within the political system, but with actual grassroots people around the state.
And if people want more information about your campaign, where can they go?
Sarah, my website is keldaforcongress.com. And Kelda, I recognize, is a funny name, but it's spelled like Zelda with a K, K-E-L-D-A, for Congress.com.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank State Representative Kelda Helen Royce for being on the Sarah Schultz Show today. Representative Royce is currently representing the 81st Assembly District. I hope we can have you back on to keep, like I mentioned earlier, to keep talking about the Gableman issue, that it's very serious. And I'd like to talk more about your campaign as you get going in the campaign season.
Anytime, Sarah. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Have a great day now.
You too.
Thanks. Now, we're coming up on the break, so after this break, I will be back with Elizabeth Wheeler from Clean Wisconsin, who will be discussing the giveaway to the mining company's mining bill. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
So, my lads, I need to leave you. My intentions, no degree.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The new year is off to an old start. Workers rallying at state houses to defend their rights. Jesse Russell has more.
2012 is starting off much like 2011 with images of concerned citizens filling state houses. This year, instead of the images starting in Wisconsin, they're starting in Indiana, where workers are opposing a Republican plan to turn the state into a so-called right-to-work state. The legislation would ban businesses and unions from writing contracts that would require employees to pay dues to the unions that represent them. Last week, members of the NFL Players Association challenged legislators to vote against the legislation, as they considered it an attack on workers. This week saw Oklahomans standing with their Indiana counterparts, detailing how right to work has had a negative impact on their state. Jesse Isbell is an Oklahoma worker.
There is no anecdotal or empirical evidence that right to work has benefited Oklahoma state economy in any way. The truth is, it has driven down wages.
Oklahoma was the 22nd state to pass the legislation. Since that legislation passed, manufacturing jobs continue to move to Mexico and overseas. The most recent company to pack up was Bridgestone Tire, where Isbell was an employee of 36 years.
When you think of medical helicopter pilots, you may not immediately think union. But Dan McDade is a med flight chopper pilot who is also president of OPEIU Local 109, affiliated with the Professional Helicopter Pilots Association. This is the most challenging time of year for pilots who must keep an irregular schedule.
The pager, the tones can go off at, 2 o'clock in the morning. And usually, like 2 and 3 in the morning when we have to go fly, that's kind of like the most dangerous time, only because it's hard to get any kind of a sleep cycle where we shift from days to nights and things like that. So, and you're on for 12 hours at a time. So we do have crew rest issues.
McDade says unionized pilots have a voice on the job, a critical voice when it comes to safety.
The guys doing the job needed to be a factor in controlling their safety. Most of the safety improvements that have happened because of the unions that have brought those safety changes and made them happen. If a federal regulation needs to happen, it is not usually the company that is lobbying Congress to make it happen. Usually it's the unions.
This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO and by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I'd like to welcome Elizabeth Wheeler from Clean Wisconsin to the Sarah Schultz Show. Elizabeth has a BS in environmental biology from Beloit College, and she has a strong understanding of Wisconsin's unique ecology and biological diversity, a foundation that helps her to frame legal issues from an environmental science perspective. Ms. Wheeler earned her law degree from Pace University, has interned with New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation's Wetland Division, the Blacksmith Institute, working on international environmental justice, and the State of Wisconsin Department of Justice Environmental Protection Unit. Prior to joining Clean Wisconsin's expert legal staff, Ms. Wheeler managed REAMP, a multi-state collaborative of nonprofit groups and foundations working on climate change issues in the Midwest. During her time with REAMP, Ms. Wheeler was instrumental in growing the network from 70 organizations and a single staff person to more than 120 organizational members and a staff of 15, ultimately greatly but she did a great job at bringing the Midwest role in the advancement of energy policy. And there's more to the bio. We have a limited amount of time with Elizabeth Wheeler, and I didn't want to keep going. So she has an amazing bio. So thank you so much for being on the show today, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Clean Wisconsin released a two-page fact sheet that discusses the main problems with the giveaway to the mining companies mining bill, or AB 426. And what you found was the biggest change to the mining laws.
You know, this is pretty much a complete overhaul of our current metallic mining laws, specifically for the iron mining industry. And the biggest top-line changes that are to our existing law include silencing the voice of the public, rolling back our common sense environmental protections that are currently in place, eliminating accountability and scientific decisions at the DNR for permitting a mine, and allowing the potential for acid mine drainage from iron mining.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the acid mine drainage? I know that was a big thing on your sheet, and I want people to understand the damage that can be done by that.
Yeah, absolutely. Acid mine drainage essentially obliterates river and other water ecosystems. It's when there's any sulfates present in the ore body, it's possible for those sulfates to leach into the groundwater or run off into streams and rivers and lakes and do really large amounts of damage to the ecosystems. It kills fish, it kills plants, it kills all sorts of living organisms.
So it basically decimates the waters around.
Exactly.
Okay, now, according to your fact sheet, I wrote down a couple of these things that really stuck out for me.
Sure.
Now, the bill eliminates requirements that water level measurements and groundwater samplings be submitted to the DNR. To me, that's huge. How important is that change?
It's really important, and I think that it's part of this overall question about accountability and scientific measures to ensure that our environment is being protected. There's sort of an overall exemption for the iron mining industry as an industry to have a blanket exemption to these really basic scientific principles for protecting our environment. Now, that's not afforded to any other industry in Wisconsin right now, and certainly no other industry that's doing something that's as impactful to our environment as mining.
Well, if the DNR is not testing the groundwater, is there any other group that would be testing the groundwater, or is that just going to be completely not tested at all?
It wouldn't be tested anywhere within, I believe under the bill, it's 2,500 feet of the mine. So if the groundwater is being impacted, it will end up being tested beyond that 2,500 feet radius of the mine, so basically a circle about a mile wide around the mine is going to be exempted from those groundwater testing requirements. Beyond that, they will have to do testing and report to the DNR what the levels are. But if you're living anywhere closer than a mile from the mine, then your groundwater could be impacted and you wouldn't even know.
If you catch the groundwater contamination within a mile of the mine, is there any way to actually stop it from leaking into any of the rest of the water in the area? Or once it's already hit the groundwater, you're just in trouble?
Well, that's why right now it is required that you have to do testing closer to mining sites or other possible groundwater contamination sites like landfills. And if you do catch the contamination early on, there are measures that you can take that will reduce the levels of contamination or prevent it from spreading even farther. However, once it gets beyond a mile from the contamination site, it's going to be really hard to stop because it's going to be pretty deep in the aquifer and it's going to be contaminating sort of all parts of that aquifer and ecosystem around.
Do you know of any mine that doesn't contaminate the groundwater?
I would not like to speak to that just because I have not done an extensive study on all of the mines, but I do know that recently the Flambeau mine, which was permitted under our existing metallic mining laws, has found significant contamination in their groundwater, and that's been in the news a lot recently.
Okay, so I'm trying to think if there's another way I can rephrase this question that, I know there's been iron ore mines in Minnesota. Now,
yes.
The iron ore mines in Minnesota, have they found that there has been water contamination with those mines over there?
I have not heard about groundwater contamination specifically, but I do know that those iron ore mines in Minnesota have experienced some acid mine drainage. And so I would guess that there are other contaminants that are seeping into the groundwater. I don't know about the levels, and I haven't heard about any specific safety guidelines being exceeded.
Okay. Now, once this bill gets passed, how much input would the public have with any of the mining information?
Under this bill, there is extremely limited public intervention allowed in the mining decision. And that's one of the biggest concerns that Clean Wisconsin has with the mining bill, because one of the most fundamental tenets of environmental law is that the environment belongs to all of us, and we all should have a right to speak up and protect it. And so that's why you see things that are somewhat unique to environmental law, like citizen suits, where a citizen can actually go in and force it directly against a violator. However, this bill strips back a lot of those citizen participation avenues, the biggest one being the contested case hearing. And I'm more than happy to talk a little bit more about that, but just to mention the other ones that this bill does is to take away the right for citizens to sue directly against the mining company if there is a violation, and it takes away some other hearings and process procedures for citizens to intervene and testify in front of the DNR and in front of the state about the potential impacts of this mine on their environment.
Well, I do want you to go into the contested case hearing. Before we do that, I want to know, given the detrimental environmental impacts, has Clean Wisconsin partnered with any of the outdoor sportsman clubs who would also have a vested interest in an unpolluted environment?
You know, there are a lot of different stakeholders that are very interested in this potential mine that's been proposed in northern Wisconsin, and we've been somewhat involved primarily with the River Alliance and the Bad River Indian Tribe and Midwest Environmental Advocates. We have not necessarily reached out to sportsmen groups yet, but that certainly is a possibility, and I would guess that those groups have a vested interest in making sure that environment in northern Wisconsin is protected.
Now, can you go into the contested case hearing? So this is another there's so many really important points that this bill just decimates. And this is one of them that people hear it and go, I don't really get it, and move on. So can you really get into a little bit of what that is and how important those things are?
Yeah. Right now, the contested case hearing is what's called a master hearing in the mining procedure for permitting a mine. And the contested case hearing is a really, really important procedural avenue for getting a permit in place, because what it does is it allows all of the information that is provided about the mine in the environmental impact statement, in the application, in the reclamation plan, in the mining plan, all of these things are presented before the Department of Natural Resources in sworn testimony. So the mining company has to go into the Department of Natural Resources, present all of this information, bring in experts, and it has the same weight as if you were to give that testimony in a court of law. So it's actually holding the mining company and people that are challenging the mining company's information accountable for what they're saying. And in a contested case hearing, you can intervene in the hearing and bring in your own experts and cross-examine the mining company's experts, and they can cross-examine your experts. And it's really an important way to build a record and build a body of information that the Department of Natural Resources can then rely on in order to make an informed decision that has all of the information in front of it at once about whether to permit the mine, where the specific conditions might need to be on the mining permit in order to make it a safe and environmentally sound project. Now, if you take that out, the Department of Natural Resources essentially just has to rely on whatever the mining company says and whatever the Department of Natural Resources is able to independently verify. And in a lot of cases, they may not necessarily have the resources or the ability to independently verify things or the resources to bring in outside experts that groups like Clean Wisconsin or other environmental groups or, say, the Bad River Indian Tribe or any other interested parties might be able to bring more information and more data and more perspective to the project.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back then with Elizabeth Wheeler. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show. If you have any questions for Elizabeth about the mining bill, you can call in at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. We'll be right back.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. When the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists warns us that we're getting closer to global extinction, we better pay attention. This week, the group announced it was turning its doomsday clock forward from 6 minutes to midnight to 5 minutes to midnight. It did so because the world's leaders aren't sufficiently addressing the crushing problems that are bearing down on us. Chief among these are global warming and the proliferation of nuclear weapons. The group noted slippage over the past couple of years in the commitment of world leaders to deal with global warming. This largely reflects the foot-dragging by the U.S., While Obama's words have been better than his predecessors, his actions have been all but indistinguishable. As a result, the risk of a climate catastrophe grows by the day. On top of that, there's still 19,000 nuclear weapons awash across the globe, with 95% of them held by the U.S. and Russia. And these nuclear superpowers haven't made a serious move to rid the entire world of nuclear weapons. In fact, while Obama has spoken well about the need for nuclear disarmament, his new Pentagon strategy says that while these weapons are still with us, we're going to threaten to use them more than ever. And so the clock keeps ticking. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We are talking with Elizabeth Wheeler from Clean Wisconsin. The call-in number, if you have any questions, is, again, 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896, and you're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show. Now, before I get into the wetland bill, the one thing that kind of interests me with this contested hearings is that the bill actually says that the DNR cannot request other pertinent information from a mining company during the course of their permit application. And that would have been covered in the contested hearing, but with removing the contested hearing, you're not getting any pertinent information other than what the company put in the permit. Is that correct?
Right. Well, the DNR is allowed to request other information from the mining company. However, the mining company doesn't necessarily have to provide it under this bill to the DNR if it's not on the list of just a few documents that they're required to provide as part of their application. And that's one. That's another way that this bill significantly reduces DNR's ability to make an informed decision, is by not requiring additional information, by stating that an application is complete, regardless of the quality of the information, the application is complete if certain documents such as a mining plan or reclamation plan are present. Now, the mining plan and reclamation plan might be significantly deficient, and DNR is not allowed to sort of stop the timeline for their decision in order to ask for more information or other pertinent information that might be required to make their decision.
Now, would these changes in this bill be specific to iron ore mining, or would this giveaway to the mining company's mining bill open the doors to unregulated mining in general?
Right now, it is specific to iron mining, and if this passes, you know, we would strongly advocate not allowing any of these provisions to be extended to other types of mining in Wisconsin.
Would it then set a precedent to maybe open that up to other types of mining, like fracking? Or the sand fracking mining?
Well, sand mining right now is, sand mining is non-metallic mining, which is regulated under a different set of rules under Wisconsin's law. And I would definitely be worried that once we write the rules specifically to iron mining, other industries might see that as an opportunity to come in and see if they can get special rules written for them as well.
Now, the Great Lakes Compact. How will that affect the giveaway to the mining companies mining bill? That's my nickname for the mining bill, by the way, is the giveaway to the mining companies, because just saying it's a mining bill doesn't really tell you what it is. And I really think this is a giveaway to the mining companies mining bill. So how will the Great Lakes Compact affect this bill?
Right, and I'm really glad you asked about that, because it's a really important question, and we've been working with other attorneys in the field to really grapple with that question and figure out how this bill would interact with the Great Lakes Compact, which is a really important and historic piece of legislation that was passed in 2008 that covers all of the Great Lakes states, plus, I believe, at least one Canadian province. And the Great Lakes Compact basically says that you can't take water from the Great Lakes to use if it's going to result in a significant adverse impact to the Great Lakes ecosystem. And it's a really important piece of legislation because we're worried about future water supply and the Great Lakes being such a great freshwater resource is an important thing for Wisconsin especially to make sure to protect. And this bill essentially says that iron mining companies can take as much water as they need for a mining project, even if it does have an adverse impact on the environment, so long as there's an economic benefit, and that economic benefit is deemed to outweigh the significant environmental impact of that water withdrawal. And so it could create a potential conflict with the Great Lakes Compact, and it could sort of carve out this way that Wisconsin is attempting to undermine the Great Lakes Compact by exempting iron mining industry. And the reason that this is so significant in this bill is because the proposed mine that GTAC has been talking about and that this bill is clearly written to accommodate in northern Wisconsin is estimated to need approximately 41 million gallons per day. And it is within the Lake Superior watershed. And just for reference, that is the same amount of water, or actually slightly more water, than the entire city of Madison uses every day. So it's a really significant amount of water that's needed for this mine.
And do you think that if the Great Lakes Compact is needed to approve this, do you think that that approval will be given or no?
You know, it's really hard to say. The very first diversion application is actually under consideration right now for the Great Lakes Compact. Under the compact, this type of withdrawal would technically be illegal. However, Wisconsin still has some authority to, permit the withdrawals or not permit the withdrawals. So it would be an interesting conflict to see it play out. I can't say one way or another if it would be approved or not.
Okay. Now, can you provide a quick synopsis on how this bill came to be and why this bill at this time and who is actually behind it?
Well, it's an interesting question as well. We saw a very similar version of this bill released earlier in spring of 2011. And it was withdrawn at that time because it was what I heard was actually that Scott Walker said that it was too extreme and we should take some more time and really look at what the contents of the bill are. And in the meantime, a Senate committee was formed to look at the issue of iron mining in Wisconsin and look at our laws and see if there were ways that our laws could be approved to make iron mining more viable in Wisconsin. And in the meantime, the Assembly released this version of the bill, AB 426, which is substantially similar to what we saw released in earlier in 2011. And what we heard earlier in 2011 when the first version was released was that GTAC, the mining company that has been proposing this iron mine in northern Wisconsin, was responsible for a large chunk of what was in the bill. And now we have some assembly authors that are stepping up and saying that they have – they have worked with GTAC to put together this bill. But it was written largely in secret. No environmental groups were consulted on the content of the bill. And in fact, when we were at the hearing, the first hearing of the assembly committee that introduced the bill, many of the committee members hadn't even seen the bill before it was released to the public.
So basically, it was released to the public and everyone just got it at the same time. No one had a background or anything about it.
Correct.
And when is this going to be up in, they're talking next week, isn't it? Next Thursday, this is going to be up in the assembly?
Yeah, I heard that there was a possible vote coming up next week.
Now, that's just the assembly. The Senate has yet to even set anything up, correct?
Correct. There is no version of a mining bill in the Senate right now.
So even if the assembly passes it, you still have a chance that the Senate might have something different with it.
Correct. And like I said, they've formed a mining and jobs committee to look at this issue, and so they might have some additional thoughts about what a mining bill should look like and if we should even have one.
Okay. Now, we have about 2 minutes left, and I really wanted to get to this wetland bill because I think it's kind of complementary to the mining bill, unfortunately. Now, can you give just kind of an overview of this wetland bill that was just released?
Sure. I think it was released about 2 weeks ago, a proposal to allow a lot more leniency in our wetlands filling rules and guidelines. Right now, wetlands are not generally supposed to be filled by developers or developed or destroyed in any way because they're such an important resource for Wisconsin. And there's a proposal that would make it much easier to fill and destroy wetlands.
How does this protect the people of Wisconsin and protect the wetlands? I mean, obviously the wetlands connected to the water, and there's so much that, especially in northern Wisconsin, that people just rely on these on the natural environment to go up, to enjoy, to it's beautiful up there and vacation up there. How is that going to affect those type of things, and how will that kind of thing actually protect the people of Wisconsin and the waterways?
Well, I you know, Clean Wisconsin is against the bill. We oppose it, and I don't believe that it will protect the waterways. I do think that there are some positive changes in that bill, and they do make some common sense changes to our wetland permitting process that should be made. However, they've coupled it with this ability to basically fill pretty much any wetland that you want to, as long as you offer to create wetlands someplace else. But anybody with a scientific background knows that's not the way that ecosystems and wetlands work. You can't just destroy one over here, make one over there, and it all sort of evens out. It is a much more delicate balance, and where there's a natural wetland, you might presume that it's there for a reason and it's filling some sort of ecological purpose. And this bill basically takes our current standard, which is no filling wetlands, avoid at all costs, and makes it into you can fill as long as you create another wetland someplace else.
And if you want more information, if people want more information on either the giveaway to the mining companies bill, which is AB 426, or the wetland bill, where can they go?
They can go to cleanwisconsin.org and sign up for our action alerts or visit our Facebook page.
And that's Clean Wisconsin on Facebook?
Correct.
All right. Well, I have to thank Elizabeth Wheeler from Clean Wisconsin for coming on the Sarah Schultz Show today. I hope I can have you on again, and hopefully maybe we'll talk about something a little friendlier and nicer than these horrible bills that they're trying to destroy our environment with.
That sounds great. Thanks, great. Sarah.
Thank you so much. Have a good day now.
You as well.
Thanks.
Bye.
We're coming up on top of the hour break here. And after this break, I will be talking with Frank Kane and Cyrus Hester about how the mine will affect the people who live up north. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
So there you sit in your cushy chair, just keep on doing all the talking.
Woo-hoo. Woo-hoo.
So there you sit in your cushy chair, just keep on doing all the talking.
You are listening to The Sarah Schultz Show. I'd like to introduce our next guest. I have Frank Kane from Save the Water's Edge and Cyrus Hester from the Bad River Reservation Environmental Services. If you have any questions for Cyrus or Frank, you can call at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. Welcome to The Sarah Schultz Show, guys.
Morning,
Good morning, Sarah. Good morning, Cyrus.
Morning, Frank.
Well, my first question goes to Cyrus. How will the mine affect you on the Bad River Reservation?
Well, that's a big question, Sarah. There's a lot of uncertainty. Some of it has to do with just the need for more information, more research to understand how the system functions, the hydrology, the way the water flows, and then also, not aside from the natural functions of the system, what is the company going to be doing? And until we have a permit application where the company commits in writing to certain practices, it's going to be difficult to assess. But we can look and have looked to mining cases throughout the region, throughout the world, and what we see is consistently these operations are intense operations, large scale, particularly taconite, open pit mining being the most disruptive method of resource mineral extraction that I'm aware of. And when you put that and couple that with what we know of the fairly pristine system, fairly intact system at the watershed scale, and that any changes, any pollution, discharge, runoff that happens from that will be transported downstream through the Bad River Reservation, through the Kokagon Bad River Sloughs, in a narrow little, 300-foot mouth of a river into Lake Superior. There's a lot of potential implications all the way down, and there's communities all the way down that stream system, including the Bad River Tribe and their the tribal membership's connections to the land and their use of resources. So it's difficult to answer. That's such a broad question that covers so many different things. And I think the one answer is that there's a lot of potential implications. It's going to take a lot of time to understand that, and that should be that's a cautionary note for the idea of fast tracking, for the idea of moving swiftly on these types of projects.
Well, how many people are affected from the waterways that will be or could be contaminated then? You said that the Bad River Reservation and people live off of it. Are there other communities as well that are down there that will be affected by that with the water being gone?
Absolutely. There's local townships, the town of Mellon, Morris Township, and I'm sure a number of other local rural communities that are in the immediate vicinity, whether they be downstream or whether they be affected by the noise from the site, the blasting, the air pollution that's likely to come off site, the changes to the landscape. So it's not certainly not just the tribe that'll feel the impacts. There are many other communities as well.
And Frank, how will the mine affect the people living up north, even if you're not directly affected with the mine being your backyard like it is in the Bad River Reservation?
Well, the mine will have the effect of changing the landscape of the Pinocchio Hills and a good section of pristine wilderness in Wisconsin forever. I think the more difficult issue to handle is, from 10 years of being on the Bayfield County Board and 10 years of being town chairman, that even in a county or a township, when you hastily make pass resolutions or pass ordinances, if you don't have a discussion with the community, the ordinances and these resolutions are almost meaningless or bankrupt because you don't have buy-in. People don't understand the process. And that's a greater concern to me because the way this has unfolded, it's been since January just an up and down, a rock and roll kind of approach by a few people down there in government, Mary Williams and Jeff Fitzgerald and the Scott Walker fellow and a handful of people that have said, well, we need this legislation passed. They go to the people that want the legislation to meet their needs, and say, we need a bill, so help us write it. So they write a bill, and they make a couple attempts to pass it through, and it founders around. And now we're down to where, after what, one public hearing in northern Wisconsin, maybe two, one down in southern part of the state. On Wednesday or Thursday, rumor has it, we're going to vote on this bill. So I think the mind is important, and it can be devastating. The process is even worse, because tribal government has been completely left out of this. The public voice has been left out of this. And we have little faith in anything that can come out of this legislation. You know, there's people in the Senate that say, well, it gets to the Senate, we can fix it and we can rewrite it. There's nothing that's fixable. The process is bankrupt to begin with. And, you know, we've always had this doctrine of public good. Well, that's been changed now to, you know, subtle changes to what's the common good. And, you know, the common good and the public good. And I'm not sure what the public good is, or what the common good is, but I have a sense of what the public good, you know, doctrine means. To me, it's this legacy of 50 years of conservation, strong conservation ethic in Wisconsin. This legislation is dismantling that. So there's no way to fix that. No matter what happens, the threat is here. There should be no hearing today. I don't understand how legislators can say, well, one person wants to vote on this week, and he's put it on an agenda, and we're going to vote on it. That makes no sense. This is the largest project that Wisconsin has seen, certainly in my lifetime. And it has been so minimized and compared to underground excavation, as compared to, you know, pick and shovel kind of mine operations, and we're moving to a full-blown facility that's going to manufacture taconite pellets. And most people up here are really opposed to the process, if not everyone. Now, there are people that can say, if we can get good rules and good legislation and we can protect the water, they'll support the mine. Well, that's the challenge. And that's what we should be looking at. And the we is the collective wisdom of science, the societal impacts. You know, what's going to happen? We don't know. All we can do is look at third world countries and say it's been devastating there. And that's the same process that they're using on us. So, you know, are we part of Wisconsin? Are we part of the system? If you ask the Cirrus or Caterpillar or, you know, Milwaukee legislators, the answer is no. No, we're just an area that has resources that they want, and whatever it takes, they're going to go after those resources.
Well, Cyrus,
I
was going to ask Cyrus, Frank mentioned the effect socially. Now, what is the effect socially to the Bad River Reservation if the mine does go in?
Yeah, one of the important things to understand is that when you make decisions, particularly around resources, over time, you know, you leave a legacy of how those resources are managed. You change the landscape and how those resources are distributed. That means you change how people come together around those resources, the way they socialize, the way they communicate. And I don't think there's a more important or relevant example than wild rice, which ties directly into the migration story of the Ojibwe people. It's very much a historical identity-driven, family-driven harvest process that happens every fall around this rice, around this annual wetland species that's highly sensitive to changes in the environment, highly sensitive to some of the constituents, the runoff that we see from mining operations in Minnesota, namely sulfate, but certainly other things like, you know, sediment accumulation, others. When you change the hydrology, you change the water quality, and it detrimentally impacts, in this case, say, wild rice, that's going to change how families are coming together, how grandparents and grandchildren are coming together to harvest that rice, friends are coming together to process that rice, it changes that whole dynamic and makes a very different situation for how people are socializing, how these traditions that have lasted hundreds of years are being passed on. So that change, those decisions that change the landscape have a cascade effect and change the way communities function. That's just the direct result, and that's totally independent of what Frank was talking about, the process, and how the way you approach the process can create its own divisions amongst members of the community when people feel isolated or disempowered or polarized by simplifying this issue into something like environment versus jobs, when it's infinitely more complicated than that, and people feel they have to pick a side, and that inherently promotes conflict in the region. That being said, I was really impressed at the hearing that the local communities were moving beyond that and respecting each other's voices, even if the process itself was in many ways, encouraging polarization. That was to some extent being resisted, and that was nice to see. That was encouraging to see from the communities up here.
So I'm going to go back to the wild rice, and I want to get back to the meeting because there's so much going on with this. How important is this, that wild rice? I mean, that's really the basis of the Ojibwa people, isn't it, that rice is a staple for the people on all aspects?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to find a correlate, but it's a central resource. Sometimes I say, it'd be like, imagine if the Garden of Eden was a place that people could go to and visit and see in its intact condition, and then someone was going to put an oil refinery that was going to discharge into it. People across the world would rise up and say, that's appalling, you can't destroy this resource. And yet in many ways, as a real place, in this case, a real place that people go to, have gone to for generations, taught traditions, managed a resource, resisted development of this site to protect it, and is about to be recognized as a wetland of international importance, very likely, it's hard to communicate in words the importance of a site like that and what the loss of it would mean to a people.
Now, going back to the meeting in Hurley, why don't you, I want Cyrus, you to answer, and then Frank can fall in on this. How did that go? What was the view of the people who were at this meeting? Because we're not really hearing much about that down here.
Right. My sense of the meeting is that it was very clear that the region, regardless of individuals' perception or belief in the ultimate mining project, the region rejected this bill, and there were voices against the bill from all over the north, from Mercer, from Mellon, from Saxon, Sanborn, Ashland, Bayfield. People even drove as far from Minnesota to offer cautionary notes of what mining, what they've seen mining do in their communities and to their regions. So people were really, really driven, and there were numerous folks who got up and testified and said, we would like to see mining, we'd like to see job production. Very understandable. We don't want to see it at the cost of water, at the cost of our environment. And we don't want to see disrespect towards tribal governments or loss of their resources. And so that's the kind of message that really seemed to unify the region. And even those who supported the bill in many cases really still rejected some of the financial support for local communities and how that was distributed. So, I mean, across the board, there were issues with it that were raised, and I think that was important, and that needs to be reflected upon by the assembly and other decision makers.
And the most of the people who are talking, then, what was the majority of people for it or against it? What were people?
Yeah, our preliminary estimates was about 60 against, 40% for, 60% against, 40% for, with very powerful testimony against the process, the bill, like I said, a lot of mutual respect and appreciation for other opinions. People don't want to see this divide their region and don't want to see the control taken away from the north when they consider that the resource is up here and the impacts will stay up here. So that's a Anyways, that was a powerful point.
You are listening to The Sarah Schultz Show, and we are talking with Cyrus Hester and Frank Kane. They're both Nauni. Does Frank have Save the Water's Edge? And Cyrus is from the Bad River Reservation Environmental Services, but they are both up from up north, and they're affected by the mine and the impact the mine will have up in that region. Now, Frank, talk a little bit about that Hurley mining meeting. It was kind of interesting the way it all came about and where it went and the background of the person who actually held, where they actually held that. It was an interesting kind of a turn of events.
Well, I think there were, and I think Cyrus characterized that meeting quite well. The one part of that hearing that surprised me was how little the committee really understood the dynamics of tribal governments in northern Wisconsin. Now, we had years ago a very contentious spear fishing issue up here. And when people had the knowledge, it all disappeared. But out of that came a commission that sat down with tribal government, state government. State government had the Department of Natural Resources. Tribal government had LIFWC, Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. And they sat down and looked at the resource and came up with ways of harvesting walleye, harvesting deer, you know, things like that. And that meets very often, and it's a very effective tool for collaboration. It's a very effective tool for allowing the process of consensus to work. When it comes to the mining issue, we forget about that. We being, you know, our government in Madison forgets about that and turns automatically to an economic argument, to a taxation argument, and they throw these things on the table that the counties want 100% and the state wants 50% of the tax revenue that comes out of mining, and is it going to be on the gross income and the net income? And we get into these intense debates over things that aren't even a reality yet. And what we're talking about is legislation, and we're talking about a new process for which our state agencies work. Well, they don't have the money, and they don't have the personnel, they don't have the resources to effectively represent the water in our system. So you infuse into that Mary Williams, who I don't think really understands the history of Wisconsin, and you put in urban legislators who look at their communities and say, we need to do the very best we can for our communities, and we can generate a lot of jobs, and we can make Wisconsin an industrial giant, and we can change the way the tech schools operate, and the ideas just keep coming and coming and coming, and no one ever sits back and says, well, what's the goal here? What are we really trying to do? And questions arise about where was this discussion of jobs and economic health in northern Wisconsin a year before GTAC showed up? Well, no one ever listened to suggestions and things that came from the north. You know, that would be an issue that they could sit down with tribal governments and say, okay, how do we jumpstart the economy? There needs to be a greater discussion of all of these issues, and not engine. The engine for that is the mining industry. That's a small component of who we are, but they can have a lasting effect. And I think that sense came across in the hearing. We had over 100 people, almost 100 people since the hearing, want to get on the citizens' concerns about the Pinocchio Hills Facebook site. I've had probably 65, 70 emails from people saying, we want to get on your webpage. We want to get on your weekly updates. So how can we access that? So we're just beginning to get the message out, and people are really waking up to what's going on. And now we're to the point where we can start having a meaningful discussion. And these guys want to go pass legislation. Yeah, that's not good government. It certainly isn't fair. And it's really disrespectful of the people that live here, and especially our tribal governments.
Hey, Frank, who is Mary Williams, first of all, for people who don't know?
Well, Mary Williams is the representative that is chair of the Assembly Committee on Jobs, the Economy, and Employment. And I think, at least in my view, this committee was thrown together as an afterthought, because conventional wisdom downstate is that the Assembly will just blindly vote for this bill. There will be opposition. There are good people in the Assembly that will put up a good fight, but I don't know that they'll prevail. And then it goes to the Senate. And, of course, we have a Senate that has a committee that's set up that's called Jobs for Minds. So I don't know how closely, you know, if Mary Williams is just a pawn in this process, or if she is just so passionate about creating jobs and tax revenue that selling Wisconsin's resources makes good sense, that's a balance to her, that's fine. But I don't think that she has put together, you know, her she's good with the gavel. She likes beating on the gavel. She has a difficult time, I think, controlling a meeting. And I don't think she gives the leadership to a committee that the committee needs. I don't think she provides them direction. I don't think she instills confidence in the people that are at the meeting. She seems to be more like, I think she said at a hearing, she was a teacher, a school teacher, and I was also, and she seems to be more interested in having a bell on her desk and tapping it and saying, okay, class, let's get quiet, in managing the behavior on the playground as opposed to the actual instruction. And what she needs to be doing is to actually setting the bar for leadership in the committee to make certain that she's nonpartisan, to make certain that everyone is treated fairly and respectfully, and to make certain that all voices are heard. Allowing 3 minutes.
I don't mean to cut you off. We're running out of time. There's one more thing I want to hit, but why is this bill coming out of her committee? Why is it not coming out of the environmental committee? Why is it coming out of her committee?
I think the environmental committees are too strongly opposed to it. I think that if there's opposition in Madison, it's coming out of the committees that are charged with actually taking care of the environment. This jobs and committee that Mary Williams runs, I don't think was ever put together with the thought of a 22-mile open pit mine that's a $2 billion operation to get it started in northern Wisconsin. That's just out of the scope of her committee.
Now, Cyrus, I want to talk a little bit about treaty rights and how they fit into this. Can you give us a basic intro into treaty rights?
Sure, I can do a brief coverage. I mean, basically, it stems from the fact that a series of treaties were signed in the early to mid-19th century, where the Chippewa tribes united and went to the federal government and said, agreed upon ceding parts of the land and, you know, for habitation, for use by the federal government or by the citizens of the United States. But in those lands that were ceded, the tribes retained certain rights. So it's been described to me as imagine if you had a bundle of sticks and you gave a certain amount of them to a friend to create a fire or something like that, but you retained some. So those remain yours. They're not really open for debate or discussion. They're still yours. And under the treaty rights, where the rights are retained, it's the right to hunt, fish, gather, those types of rights. And so throughout these what's called the ceded territories, those lands that were ceded in the treaties, the tribal members retain the rights to hunt, fish, and gather in those lands. And what that leads to is not just that they can fish or spearfish or harvest medicine plants, but that the habitat exists to make sure those resources are there and that tribal members have access to them. So that's, I think that's one piece of how this relates to mining. If the state of Wisconsin decides to have a mine operation that drastically impairs the resources and inhibits tribes' ability to get the resources because they're no longer there, or that they can't, for instance, if fish are too polluted to actually consume, which was the point of the treaties, have subsistence, or one piece of the treaties, then that's a violation of their rights that were set, that were agreed upon between the tribes by their ancestors and the federal government. So that's, I think that's how these start to play in.
Is there, and you got to be real fast, you have about a minute left.
Yeah.
Is that going to be able to be enough to stop this mining bill going through, or is that just one piece of the puzzle that, that might be able to stop them from doing this?
It's one piece of the puzzle. I don't feel comfortable that I could say it gives the tribes any veto power. It's something that needs to be looked at seriously from the legal standpoint, but I think it really goes back to what Frank was saying, that it goes back to just understanding tribes, talking with them, considering the northern landscape, the northern communities when thinking about these projects, and that hasn't happened.
Okay, now what's a website people can access to get more information on the giveaway to the mining company's mining bill, or how people will be affected up north? I know, Frank, you've got one.
Save the Water's Edge. .com or email is the same, savethewatersedge@gmail.com. We are collecting most everything we possibly can. I think Clean Wisconsin, Sierra Club, Wisconsin League of Women Voters, or Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters, Trout Unlimited, Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. All of those websites have a tremendous amount of information on the legislation and the impacts of the legislation. And, of course, you can look at any of the recall websites, and they usually allude to some of the issues with mining and legislation also. There's a lot of information out there, and if people do have specific questions that they can't find an answer for, they can certainly email me. And if I don't have the answer, I certainly know people that would provide an answer.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank Frank Kane from Save His Water's Edge and Cyrus Hester from the Bad River Reservation Environmental Services for being on the Sarah Schultz Show today. Thank you, guys. Good luck with the fight. And I guess we'll just see what happens next week.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Frank.
Thanks. Well, thanks for coming on.
Take care.
So, yep, you too. Bye. Well, we're a little bit past 10:30, but we're gonna go to a break, and we will be right back with Bob Puray, owner of the Puray Social Media Management, discussing the correct uses of social media messaging. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show.
Let's hear it for American Tradition Partnership. It's an organization that stands up for the politically dispossessed in our land. It goes to the highest courts to assert the fundamental rights of a minority that's been denied its full voice in America's political and governmental power circles. Yes, American Tradition Partnership is a tenacious advocate for, cue the patriotic music, corporations. Huh? Despite its grandiose name, American Tradition Partnership is a front group that funnels money from corporations into various political ads attacking candidates whom the corporations don't like, without identifying the corporate backers. Hoping to expand its laundry services for these secret donors, ATP filed suit in Montana to overturn the state's century-old ban on spending corporate funds in state and local elections. The front group argued that the ban restricts corporate influence over government policies. Wow, that's so twisted and anti-democratic that it'd make an American eagle scream in pain. But for arrogant corporate elites and their political lackeys, too much is never enough. The good news is that corporate lackeys don't yet control Montana's Supreme Court. On December 30th, the court's majority sided with Democracy, Common Sense, and State Attorney General Steve Bullock, who argued for the people of Montana that corporations already have beaucoup ways to assert their oversized political power without needing to funnel secret money into our elections. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the front group will now scamper to the corporate-friendly U.S. Supreme Court, pleading with it to stomp on this victory for democracy by overruling the state court and the people of Montana. To keep posted on this case and to fight for people power over corporate rule, go to www.freespeechforpeople.org. Freespeechforpeople.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Now, before we get to Bob Puray, and I know I'm saying that name wrong, and he's going to correct me, and I really apologize ahead of time, I have breaking news going on. I know Lori Compass, who was in charge of the Fitzgerald recall, had a press conference at 10 o'clock. And, I didn't get to see the press conference, but I pulled some stuff off of Twitter. And basically the press conference said that the recall, and again, this is reading off a Twitter post, the recall Fitzgerald organizers won't say how many signatures they have, only that it is more than 16,742 needed to trigger an election. They said that they will be turning in the SIGs today. And again, that's off of Twitter. And the last thing off of Twitter is they don't know who's going to run the recall, but Lori Compass says she will not be running against Fitzgerald. So great news coming out of the Fitzgerald area. They're going to trigger an election. I really hope Scott Fitzgerald gets the boot. We need to give him a pink slip. Walker needs a pink slip. They need to go. They've run this government horribly. There's no democracy left in the state of Wisconsin, and it is just great news that we will have an election in the Fitzgerald area. So with that being said, I am going to go to Bob. Say your last name, please.
Puryear.
I keep trying to say it. I even got it spelled out like that, and I still can't get it right. So I'd like to welcome Bob to the Sarah Schultz Show. Now, his bio, and this is, I asked him for a bio, and I'm going to read you what I get sent. So here it is. Originally born in New Jersey, Bob Puray, I was close. There we go.
Bob, let's go with Bob.
I'm going to go with Bob. There we go. Arrived inside the Cheddar Wall after falling in love with a Wisconsin girl on an Amtrak train. They spent 5 years in Green Bay and recently relocated to Elkhorn. Bob and his wife, Brenda, run, now I have to even say this for your social media management, Puryear, with social media management. They provide social media support and content to local businesses of all kinds, using Facebook, Twitter, blogs, and dozens of other tools. Puryear Social Media Management helps businesses of all sizes promote themselves to current and new customers. So for anyone who's not sure, because we do have people who listen who are like, social media, what's that? Can you actually give a quick definition of what social media is?
Sure. First start with what people know the names as. Things like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, blogs, even the Huffington Post is all social media. But kind of as a general definition, social media is news and information generated by the users and not by a group of generally paid people. So traditional media would be the New York Times or CNN or Fox News, where there's a group of people who get paid to generate information and then forward that information out to the world. Social media is user-generated information. So when you go on Facebook and you update that you just baked cookies with the kids, it may not be earth-shattering news, but it's news and you've put it out into the world. Or like Arianna Huffington did with the Huffington Post, she created an entire news empire around blogging where it's pseudo-opinion, pseudo-fact. Different articles are opinion, some are factual, but they're creating it, and you don't have to have a degree, you don't have to get hired by somebody to be part of the social media revolution.
So social media basically is media that's run by the people.
It is as democratized as media is ever going to get, or at least as it has ever been in human history. Everybody can start a newspaper. Everybody can start their own platform. Everybody can have their own bullhorn to either express their opinion or to do their own research and put facts out into the world.
Now, what's the best use for social media? I know people use it for all sorts of things, from advertising, just what is considered spamming, to, like you said, hey, we're out at the zoo today, to getting news out. Twitter is full of news reports. What's sure. the best way to use social media?
The best way to use it is the way that makes you happiest. Social media is about having fun. In fact, I think it's pretty cool, but Dell Corporation, the people who make the computers, and I believe at this point they are the largest PC manufacturers in the world, actually have that in their social media policy. Have fun. Social media is about enjoying yourself. So if you want to put out there that you're going to the zoo today, that's great. That's what you want to use it for. For businesses, it can be for telling people what's on your specials menu for the day, or for thanking a specific customer for being a great customer for the last 10 years and, you know, put out on Twitter or Facebook, you know, Mrs. Smith has been coming to us for 10 years and she's such a great person. It was wonderful to see her this morning. Or you could, for example, use a blog if you're a plumber, for example, and you want people to know that you know what you're doing. You could make a video of what you do, put it in a blog, and go, this is how you fix a clogged drain. Social media is very much about giving away information, and it's about sharing. So the best use for it is whatever you really want to use it for. And in the case of politics or sports or anything, it's you go find all the people who are talking about what you're interested in, you can track what they're saying, and you can interact with them no matter where they are in the world, and instantaneously or nearly instantaneously.
Now, if you wanted to get a message out, if you're doing the news, you're selling something, whatever the case is, whatever message you want to get out, what's the best way to be able to get that message? Should it be something you repeat every hour? Should it just be something you say a couple times a day? What are you finding the best ways to get that out?
Again, it depends on what you're using. Twitter, it's okay to repeat things two or three times a day or repeat the same message multiple times over the course of weeks. Because Twitter is a constant running scroll that the likelihood that I happen to be looking at your Twitter feed at that moment when you put out that piece of news is relatively low. Facebook, it's a little slower. That feed tends to be slower because you really only see the Facebook feeds of the people you want to see. You can actually, without unfriending them, you can keep them as friends but not have to look at what they write on their wall all the time. A lot of it depends on what your specific message is. If for example, you want to do a political editorial and you write a blog about it, so you put up your own article and it's all free, you can put it all up there, and you put up your own article, then you want to tell people on Facebook that you did it. You might do that, you know, two or three times over the course of a week. But on Twitter, you might do that two or three times a day for 4 or 5 days at different times of the day. So it all depends on what the message is that you're trying to get out. From a business standpoint, it depends on what you're trying to do. If you are having a sale on Saturday and it's a one-day sale, well, then you want to get that information out a lot. And kind of like TV commercials where they're constantly coming on for the 3 or 4 days before an event, you want to go ahead and put it on your Facebook two or three times in a day and maybe as much as 10 times a day in the 2 or 3 days before a big sale on Twitter because of those differences in when people are looking at things.
Now, some people swear by Twitter and they don't like Facebook. Some people like Facebook and don't, you know, they swear by Facebook and they don't like Twitter. What's the correct way of using Facebook versus what's the correct way of using Twitter?
There's no real correct way. They have two different functions. Twitter, you can follow anybody, which means you can look at anybody's Twitter feed whether they know you or not. So you can get 10,000 friends, and of those 10,000 friends, you're sitting and you're watching what they're saying, and then they in turn can choose to watch what you're saying. Facebook, on the other hand, generally it's people you know or people who are like-minded. So politically, and particularly during the latest recall, where the divisions have been very significant, you can see that people who are progressive tend to have progressive friends, but if they really looked at that list, they may not know most of those people personally, but because they saw each other on a progressive site, they've joined up. And the same thing on the right with the Republicans and the Tea Party. Those things tend to correspond with each other. And so they'll friend people on Facebook. Twitter is much more putting it out into for the whole world to see, whereas Facebook, you're putting it out just for your friends to see. There's a little caveat to that. No matter what you put out, the whole world eventually can have access to it. So you don't ever want to slander anybody, and you don't want to threaten anybody with terroristic threats, because even if you delete it 8 seconds later, it's somewhere out in the internet, and it can be found.
Okay, we're going to, you know what, before I go into it, because I really want to start talking about how the progressives are using these social medias versus how the neocon Tea Party is using social media, but I want to get to a break real fast, and when we come back, we're going to cover that. We're talking with Bob Puryear.
Excellent.
There we go, I'm getting it. And he has his own social media business called the Puryear Social Media Management. And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Hi, this is Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse. You can find us on iTunes. Recently, Scott Walker of Wisconsin gave a speech announcing that he and his administration were lifting the enrollment cap on the state's family care program. What Walker did not talk about was the fact that it was his 2011 budget that put the cap in the first place. He also did not mention that the federal government stepped in and told him and his administration that they must lift this cap. In a similar fashion, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, recently gave a speech about the payroll tax cut, where he criticized the Senate for only passing a 2-month extension while the House of Representatives passed a 1-year extension. What Boehner did not tell the American people was that his bill also cuts unemployment benefits from 99 weeks down to only 59 weeks, mandates drug testing for all recipients of unemployment, mandates a high school diploma for all recipients of unemployment, strips the EPA of their power to regulate incinerators and power plants, which could cause up to 20,000 deaths in this country. It passes the Keystone Pipeline. It cuts $8 billion from Obamacare. And if you get any kind of money from the federal government, you will not be allowed to use it at an ATM that is found in a casino, a liquor store, or a strip club. Once again, the Republican Party is showing us that they will say whatever it takes in order to win as many votes as possible from the 99% so that they can continue to pass policies that only benefit the top 1%. I'm Eric Brandt, and that's just something to think about.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show, and we're speaking with Bob Puryear, owner of the Puryear Social Media Management. If you have any questions for him, the phone number is 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. Now, I ended the last section with talking about how the progressives are doing it right. So let's jump right into that. How are progressives using social media correctly?
There's a lot of progressive information out. I think particularly the professional side, the Huffington Post, the Obama administration, and Organizing for America, they put out a lot of solid factual information in blogs or on very dynamic and colorful pages. So I think at this point, social media for the progressives is most successfully being used as a tool to get out factual information. Then that information will filter into the individual progressives. That's kind of where it gets diluted, and that's where it's not necessarily being used well. I think very often folks get onto one message. We, as progressives, folks tend to have one specific axe to grind at a time. The recall is a perfect example. There are lots of folks who are focused only on the recall, which means that everything else is falling by the wayside. So the way the progressives are using it well is they use it to get out factual information, and that is a large part of winning a political argument well, is making sure that you actually have facts to back up what you're saying.
Now, where is it? You said that they're falling. They were kind of failing as it kind of spread out a little bit. How did that? How is that not working? I mean, they get the information out. They get the factual information out. What would be a better step for them than what? What are they doing now, actually? And then, what would be a better step for them?
I think as average progressives, I think the key would be to make sure that you're keeping an eye on as much as you can. Right now, again, the recall is huge for lots and lots of folks. They're not paying a whole lot of attention to what is happening with, for example, the Obama campaign or what's happening in other states, unless it directly affects somehow the recall. So that kind of spreading out your what you're looking at and spreading out your attention span just a little so that you're able to focus on other things so that you can be anticipating what the next step is going to be. That way, when progressives get involved in conversations or get into debates on Facebook, which is a huge place for debating, it's not just a one-trick pony kind of thing. Because if the other side pulls out, well, Obama said X, you haven't been keeping up on that. You've been focused just on the Scott Walker recall, but it's all related.
Okay, so basically progressives are just kind of blinders on, focused on one or two things, and that's not what you're seeing from the other side then. So what is it that the neocons, the Tea Party people, what are they doing right?
The Tea Party is really, really good at getting information to cross the country quickly. And I follow several of the Tea Party sites and, in fact, have some friends who are Tea Party members and heads of local Tea Parties. They tend to get information across the country very quickly. So if something good goes up, say, on a Texas Tea Party site that has to do with their local Texas politics, it'll show up on a Wisconsin Tea Party site within a matter of minutes or hours. And it's relevant because it's all related, because the agendas for the different sides of the political issues tend to be the same around the country. Knowing what's going on in one place can help inform the direction that it's going to go where you live. So the Tea Party is really good at sharing information with themselves. And frankly, the Tea Party started on social media. Sure, they had rallies and those kinds of things, but the Tea Party is very much an internet-created response to Barack Obama's success with social media. He became the first internet president, and then the neocons, and depending on who you ask, it was either grassroots or it was put together by some powerful, wealthy conservatives. But either way, their response was to build a grassroots network of information that travels across the country very quickly. Therefore, all of the Tea Party people and all the conservatives tend to have the same talking points all over the country, which makes it sound like one really large voice.
And obviously the progressives aren't doing this.
Progressives tend to be more passionate about the specific issues that concern them. The union idea, for example, while that was a big part of the budget bill, was far and away not the only part of the budget bill. There were things in there that affected people who are passionate about animals. There were things in there that affected people who are passionate about government accountability. There were parts of the Walker budget bill that affected how state property is sold, and therefore the open bidding process in the government. You didn't hear a lot about that. What you heard about was the unions, and they're down in Madison, and they would speak specifically to what was happening with the collective bargaining end. You didn't see as much with people really tearing this information apart and going, wow, there's a whole lot here. Therefore, the progressives tend to stay isolated in their particular niche. The animal people know about the animal issues that were in the bill, and the people who are interested in government accountability know about those issues, and the union people know about their issues. They're not realizing they're all offended by the same bill, so to speak. Whereas the other side, the Tea Party, they share all of their different issues, for example, with Obamacare. So there might be people who are offended by the fact that the government is requiring health care, or at least health care will be more significantly mandated across the country, whereas there are other people who are concerned that this affects their Medicare. Well, they're all banded together. And again, they sound like a more cohesive voice. Whether the actual numbers are larger, that's for somebody else to decide. But the method of using it, keeping people all headed in the same direction, is really where the Tea Party has succeeded and the progressives have stayed in their passions.
So basically the Tea Party is looking at this going, okay, we got people who don't like this, people don't like this, people don't like this, but it's all, we'll just use Obamacare, it's all the health care. And so we're going to say, look at what Obamacare is doing, list, list, list.
Right.
Whereas the progressives are going, look, this is against animals because you have to sell, you know, they're only selling them for a dollar. Oh, look, this is killing the unions. Oh, look, he's getting rid of recycling instead of saying, look, this is all under Act 10.
Right, exactly. And I think if you got everybody to get to band together and forget about whatever other political differences you have, you would find that, that the progressive movement will have the cohesive strength that the Tea Party does. Now, again, it remains to be seen whether they're going to succeed in November, given how far to the right some of their representatives have gone. That's a decision for the voters. But in terms of how the message is going out, they present it as, we all have the same enemy for different reasons, whereas the progressives see it as, we all have the same enemy and this is my reason. And they're not talking to each other. They don't pass information back and forth to each other about what's important.
So the best thing a progressive can do is basically get the information and assimilate it under what it is that it's actually getting done. So they can take all the things that people are fighting and they can say, okay, this is actually all under the mining bill.
Yeah.
So let's put it out there under the mining bill and start tweeting that or Facebooking that or blogging that instead of, again, having a single issue.
And that applies in social media with everything. Say, for example, you sell cars. Gas prices affect how your cars are going to sell. So you might make a constant Twitter post of the lowest gas prices within 20 miles of your auto dealership. That doesn't seem like a related issue, but if I'm making the decision to buy an SUV versus buying a hybrid, then I need to know gas prices. And you're supporting your own argument, even though you're not approaching it from the direction that you would normally approach it, which my SUVs are the best cars in the world. Well, that's great, but I need to know where I can find cheap gas, too, to fill that thing. It applies in everything you do in social media, and that's what makes social media so great, is it's incredibly flexible, and there's so much information available that you can quickly put in that if you formulate for yourself sort of a cohesive view of, hey, other people might see it this way, well, let me look for their information too, then you eventually will build large coalitions of people who are passionate about the same subject for coming at it from different directions.
Now, what area do you consult on? Do you just cover all of social media?
Generally, yeah. There's an awful lot of social media, and there are some that are very big in Europe, and there are some that are very big in the United States. But for the most part, here in Wisconsin, and the folks that I consult for here in Wisconsin, it's Facebook and Twitter, where Twitter is not nearly as dynamic in the business community here in Wisconsin as it is elsewhere in the world. And that's something I'd like to see change, because Twitter is very, very fast and very, very effective. Not many folks here know what LinkedIn is or use it, but it's a great place if you're a professional, somebody you think of who has a degree, a lawyer, a doctor, those kinds of folks. It's a great place to network and find either new business or people who are like-minded. Blogging is huge, which is a great place to put up information about what's going on in longer format so that you can actually flesh out issues and conversations. So those are the general things, and then there's other stuff that go into the social media realm where I will consult with folks on how they can make their websites better or how to find a free website. I can show folks how to find great web hosting for free that is easy to set up and it's permanent. You own it. It's yours. And you can use that as your platform without having to spend all the money that they want you to spend when you even go to GoDaddy or whatever. You don't have to pay those folks. There are free places to go that work just fine.
Now, if people want more information about your business, where can they go?
You can call me. We'll start with the old school way. It's 262-348-8390. I have a website, Perrier, P-E-R-Y-E-A, socialmedia.webs.com, which, by the way, happens to be a free website. So if you go there, you'll be able to see what one of those looks like, and I think it's pretty okay. You can also email me at bperrier, P-E-R-Y-E-A, at yahoo.com.
And what was that phone number again?
262-348-8390.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Bob, for being on the show today. We are speaking with Bob Perrier, owner of the Perrier Social Media Management. I'll hope to have you on again soon.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Yep, you too.
Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for his work on the show this week. You can download the show from iTunes or listen to archive shows at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz. You can also now listen to the Sarah Schultz Show off the Sarah Schultz Show app for Android phones and now on iPhones. Yay, got that finally done. You can tune in Saturday at 6 p.m. to Citywide, WIDE, 99.1 FM in Madison. And on Tuesday at 1 p.m. to WHYS 96.3 FM in Eau Claire. Remember, Wisconsin, forward together, forward. Have a great week, everyone.